Buchanan with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Welcome back inside and happy holidays to the NFE Northern Football Podcast, episode 103 here on the Northern Football Podcast, our wrap-up episode, a holiday episode of sorts to wrap up 2022, a historic year for Canadian soccer, especially on the men's side. Make sure to follow us on all the social media platforms at Northern Football and follow the three of us at BenSteiner00, at GalindoPW, at Alex Gonge-Rujic, and subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Peter, Alex, happy holidays. Welcome back. And it's our year in review show on what's been a pretty incredible year of Canadian soccer.
It has. We're going to probably get into the nitty-gritty on it. But first of all, good to see you, fellas. It's been a couple of weeks because we had to split up that CanMNT postmortem into two parts. So we took a break from recording last week, and now we're about to go on hiatus again. So let's try to make the most of it. But it was a really good year, a very successful year for the podcast, for Canadian soccer. And we got some hopefully big things planned for next year, too. So it's only going up.
Exciting time for Canadian soccer, exciting time for NFP. Forget up the NFP, NFP goes up, or we can figure out a different slogan about the direction of NFP.
Promote it.
we'll see, yeah. Promotion and relegation for NFP, we're going up to the big leagues. But jokes aside, it's best time of year. Snow's coming down, you get the breaks, you're just enjoying the good vibes, being around friends, family, and everyone else. So hopefully everyone else is in similar stead, enjoying this time with all their loved ones, because I certainly know we all are, and excited for what the new year brings. You know, it's going to be a good another year of grind. 2022 is a special one, but 2023 can only find a way to be better, I'm sure.
Could be trophies for Canada in 2023 as well, in both men's and women's soccer. But we'll get into your questions, and we'll start off with Trey Dunn with a comment. NFP has become a staple in my week. Thanks, guys, for sharing and growing the game here with the World Cup qualifying journey, that being epic because of the knowledge that you've empowered fans with, making the World Cup even more enjoyable. Cheers to a historic year and more NFP to 2026. Love the comment. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for all of our regular listeners, as well as if this is your first episode that you're tuning into, our year in review episode here on the Northern Football Podcast. But our first question from @_DCF, two sentences to finish. Looking back, we will remember 2022 because blank, and looking forward, success in 2023 looks like blank. Peter, I'll start with you.
Well, I think we mentioned this on the postmortem, or at least I did, but my definition of success would be the men winning a trophy in 2023 and the women making the quarterfinals or better. And I think they are more than capable of doing that. They could be the quote unquote surprise package of the World Cup, if you want to classify them as such. But then in terms of the 2022 angle, simply put, we're going to remember it because of, I think, the journey to the World Cup more so than the actual World Cup. Maybe just from a general perspective, me personally, I'll remember 2022 because of the World Cup and the fact that Canada was there and I got to experience it. And for one of the first times, I can honestly say that, you know, not to get too emotional here, but I was almost driven to tears listening to the Canadian anthem before that Belgium game. Like, I was very, very close, and that's never happened before. Even when Peru made it in 2018, I wasn't on the brink. Of course, being there probably helps, but that's certainly what I'm going to remember it for. But I think overall, the road to that World Cup, certainly in January and March, I think was really the crowning moment of 2022 for me, with the World Cup still being, you know, relatively successful, but obviously in other ways disappointing as well.
I think for me, it would probably be, as you say, that journey to the World Cup and that day at BMO when Canada clinched against Jamaica. I just remember the three of us, we got to go down to the field as well, and just seeing the smiles on the Canadian national team's faces, seeing the smiles on the family, the tears from alumni of the national team, that was a magical day just to be a part of and be able to be in that building. And that's, I would say, probably the highlight of 2022. And looking forward to 2023, yeah, a trophy for the men. I think that's probably a reasonable goal. Sure, a trophy means that things have to go right, but with both Nations League and the Gold Cup in question this year, it's something that I think you can look forward to and legitimately as well. Of course, you won CONCACAF qualifying. There's no reason you can't go and do that in a tournament. Sure, you have the roster questions and everything that leads into a Gold Cup and a Nations League, but there's no reason that they shouldn't be able to go out and win those trophies.
Yeah, I think we'll remember 2022, obviously, because of the men's journey to the World Cup, just how it culminated and got over the line in March. And then there was a bit of 6 months of abyss, I suppose, which kind of did ruin the momentum in a sense. But then you made it and everything was always forgotten for, you know, some 180 glorious minutes of just playing at the world's highest stage. So certainly for 2022, I think that has to be the crowning moment. And, you know, in 2023, success looks like, hopefully, on the women's side now, a similarly watershed moment at the World Cup, which I feel like, forget the quarterfinals, it'd be nice if Canada could push to the semifinals. Obviously, that's a tough ask given, you know, just the scope of the European teams that are going, but it's going to be a weird World Cup. You know, a lot of the top women's players might miss out just because there's the whole injury crisis on the women's game again. You know, this weekend, obviously, Viviane Miedema, fantastic player, ruled out with knee injuries, and, you know, something that's going to have to be looked at long term. But on Canada's side of the ledger, you're looking at a few potentially dangerous teams might not be at their full strength, and Canada already a team that's growing, a team that's getting younger. It'd be interesting to see if they can push to tie, say, top four, just because that's their best ever finish when they made it to the top four back in 2003. It's been, you know, it's been 20 years. Feels like, you know, no better time with this potentially being Christine Sinclair's last dance. Last 2022 is the year of goats winning World Cups. What's stopping 2023 from being the same? But that on the women's side, then of course on the men's, just bring home a trophy. Nations League, Gold Cup, both. And I, you know, dream wise, make sure they beat the US in one of the finals. I feel like that would be hilarious and would kickstart the next decade of a great rivalry between the two.
Well, I was at the Vancouver Canucks NHL game the other night, and Christine Sinclair was speaking with the in-arena host and mentioned that the highlight of her career was winning the gold medal, of course, and that's an expected answer. But then a quick little smirk, and she said beating the Americans on the way to get there as well. So beating the Americans at the World Cup would be something special for the Canadian team, and that I'm sure that they would take that in stride as well. But we'll move on to a question from Oz Sweeney at OzSweeney4. What steps do you think the media needs to do to help push the programs to the next level? And what do you hope Canada Soccer and the players would do to help? And I know one of our colleagues in the media, Joshua Cloak, wrote how he might change his approach and how he's covering the team going into the future. And I think that the criticism of the team definitely sort of has to come into the picture. It can't be all celebrating the fact that Canada just gets to these things anymore in terms of the men's national team. And I would say that in the women's national team as well. Caitlin Kyle, former women's national team player, has come out and said on several media appearances that you have to be able to criticize the women. And I think that's something that we've done on the show in the past, and something that we'll continue to do is be able to say that, yeah, Christine Sinclair had a bad game, or yeah, there might not be all positive vibes around the team all the time. And so I think that those are important things to move forward and be a little bit, I don't want to say harsher, but a little more critical of both national teams in terms of how they're playing as well as how they're structured and organized.
Yeah, and I think part of being able to do that is by the media members who maybe haven't always covered the team through no fault of their own, because we're all at the mercy of our higher-ups and who kind of dictates what we cover. You hope that their bosses keep sending them to these events, whether it is the Gold Cup, the Women's World Cup, because that is the one thing that really struck me when I was in Qatar, guys, is just how tiny the Canadian media contingent was, even in comparison to mid-tier nations. Like, understandably, this is the number one sport in a lot of other countries, and clearly the World Cup is the biggest event in the sport, so you're going to send a lot of people if that is the number one sport. But even the U.S. outlets. Like, they were sending dozens of people over. You know, the Mexico sent dozens as well. I think Argentina had close to 400 media representatives, just to kind of put it into perspective. Now, we're not saying that 400 people should be covering Canadian soccer. I think that's very unrealistic. But I think in total, there was 16 of us. And I might even be overshooting it a little bit, just to kind of put it into perspective. And I think that's going to really play a big part. Because if there's one thing we learned, is that this sport is on the rise. People are actually starting to pay more attention. Some of the most read articles on sportshead.ca involve the Canadian men's national team at the World Cup, which I understand the World Cup bump is going to help that. But you also got to think about where this program was 2-3 years ago. The fact that it's now among the most read stories on major outlets is wild to me. So you hope that that continues. I think that also Canada Soccer does, as I mentioned on the postmortem, they have to do a little more to help us do our jobs and vice versa. And I feel like there's not enough of that synchronicity right now. The players, as I said initially, they can choose to speak to us as they please. It really doesn't make a difference to me personally. I know some who are more storytellers than analysts would probably prefer players to speak more, but that's neither here nor there. But I do think it kind of lies with the quote unquote important people to help Canadian soccer grow from a media perspective, because that's ultimately who decides. And you hope that this World Cup has led to change. I've started to see certain signs that it might, but only time will tell if it actually does.
Yeah, it's going to be a hugely important year, I suppose, for the media. And it's going to be important, I think, just to, just do storytelling, fair, accurate storytelling of all kinds. I think what's, again, huge is what we mentioned in the postmortem, is that there's a growing economy. So to stake your claim and really, you know, highlight what's going on with the economy of soccer. And that's all to say that, yeah, tell the stories and do so in ways that can push, that can elevate, that can amplify, et cetera, when something good happens. You know, you can tell the story of why, you know, not just what's good. Like, people, you know, say if Canada beats the U.S., okay, it's beating the U.S., it's a big deal. But, you know, why is it important that they beat the U.S.? Or if they win the Gold Cup, say that happens, okay, why is it important that Canada wins the Gold Cup? You know, people, they're not dumb. They're going to see the people, Canada, say, lifting a trophy, like, they understand that it's good. But to understand, it's like, okay, look, it's been 21 years since Canada last, you know, or 23 years since Canada last lifted a trophy of any kind on the men's side. This is important because, or if Canada's women's team makes the top four of the World Cup, why is it important they make the top four? Well, it's been 20 years and, you know, the game is elevated so much. So the fact they're keeping up despite a domestic pro league is great. But then also on the flip side, if and when, I mean, obviously we hope it doesn't, but if things go south, okay, why is it, you know, what's the context, what's important, what, not just also calling out, but also identifying areas of change. And, you know, if there's any other issues on the board side of affairs, you know, what's going on, why is it important to change, how do we change? I feel like it's important, yeah, to push stories forward, and when, you know, in cases where there's maybe positive stories, elevate and amplify, explain what's going on. But then when there's negative stories, do the same, but then also, you know, look at potential ways out of it, look at how Canada could be doing better, and really put that sort of fair pressure on them, so that it's, you know, we're able to amplify and push and grow things. And I think that's going to be the key from all parties, because then you go to, like Peter mentioned, from Canada Soccer, it's up to them to amplify their programs. I mean, if they want the mainstream to pick them up, of course, success helps, but they can also do their part to kind of draw the mainstream in, so that it's going to be a multifaceted ecosystem where everyone's going to have to play a role, from, you know, journalists to Canada Soccer, to the fans as well, because, I mean, as we've seen, the fans have power and they can demand accountability. They can demand, you know, other important aspects that can demand change, but can also amplify in other moments.
And this World Cup was easily the most watched in Canada as well. A shout out to @AHBSeaborn on Twitter, Adam Seaborn. He always takes quite a close look at Canadian sports media, especially the TV viewership numbers throughout every sports league season. But the World Cup final, of course, a thrilling match between Argentina and France, with Argentina coming out on top in penalties, came to an average audience of 4.8 million Canadians across TSN, CTV, and RDS, a peak audience of 7.7 million at one point at 12:54 p.m. Eastern time. That's a 23% increase on the 2018 final, when, of course, France beat Croatia in that final. And in total, 24 million Canadians watched some part of this World Cup on TV, with the most watched game being Canada versus Croatia. That one drawing in 4.4 million. And as we move on to Old Bill at Bad Wave, favorite memory of watching slash covering the Canadian men's national team this year? Further question, when will Alex get his cooking segment on the pod? The people want to know. Now, the last time Alex was cooking on the podcast, he set off the fire alarm. So I don't know whether that's coming anytime soon, but I'm sure we can make something
fake
work.
News.
Don't you dare fake rip the man fired. Who made us the best birria tacos I've ever had in my life. That will stick with me forever.
Thank you, Peter. Fake news. I mean, in terms of cooking segment, who knows? Maybe one day if I get more time, I'll fire up a TikTok or something like that, or an IG. Maybe that'll be a project of mine when I graduate school. Just like a on the side cooking IG or TikTok, because I'm having fun. I can't spoil what I'm gonna try to make this week, because it's for a holiday party that I have, and I try to make extravagant desserts every year. Last year I made homemade cinnamon buns that were just chef kiss. So this year I have another dessert that's planned that if they execute, I'll make sure to share. So 100% we're going to get more cooking in everyone's lives, because cooking, great, great stuff. And we'll have to, maybe we'll get an NFP forum going where we're sharing recipes and ideas both ways. But to answer also the great question, or Peter, if you want to hop in with some more cooking talk. But
all I was going to say is that maybe what we could do is, like, whenever the three of us are recording in the same room, we have maybe like a quick 1 or 2 minute segment about what Alex cooked this week. And then we kind of go into
I'll cook for you guys at some point too. I'll cook for you guys at some point too. I haven't cooked for you guys yet, but I make some Israeli and Jewish cuisine. So I can't share with the entire listenership, but happy to cook for you guys at some point. And I'm sure we'll get some cooking segments at some point here on NFB. But to Old Bill's question, what's your favorite memory watching or covering the men's national team this year?
It's been a wild year. I mean, we have to remember it started all the way at January 30th, I guess, because Canada, US, Tim Hortons Field. That one's like sneaky. That might be my like most underrated game, just because it was so loud and it was so surreal. And like, that was the day in my mind that they qualified, is when they beat the US at home and they were shorthanded and US had their full strength lineup and Canada just got over the line. It was, you know, it was 12,000 and I swear they fit 18,000 in there, or at least for the Tim Hortons Field game, despite restrictions. Like, that might be, you know, the overall best memory, because yeah, then after that, of course, there's March, which, you know, that's going to be special. That's the day that they qualified. So, I mean, that's no brainer. So I'd say January, maybe, in terms of just the on-field experience, just because of how special that day was and how surreal everything was. Because, like, again, March, it felt like it was building. Like, January came out of nowhere. You had the bus arrival, all this great stuff. And then off the field, I just thought the June camp, despite all the chaos and, you know, of that window, it was just, there was so much hilarity and so much good times off of it. And I think sometimes that's the great part of this. You meet some great people and you have some good times, and you know, you go, yeah, you meet people in different cities, etc. So it was nice to host all these, you know, great people we've met in Vancouver, and shared some good times over that week despite the chaos. So on the field, I'll pick January. Off the field, I'll go June.
I was about to say the exact same thing, every single word. To maybe differ from you, I'll choose a World Cup memory, because I mean, that was the crowning achievement for the team, as well as some of us who were fortunate enough to be there. I really do think it was Canada-Belgium, just from the start of the day, when I think everybody was almost very curious after going into John Herdman's post-match or pre-match press conference, I should say, and hearing him speak, and everybody kind of really only knowing about Alphonso Davies from a Canadian perspective and nothing else. I mean, maybe some of the English press were aware of Herdman's story after a while, but then the Belgium game happens. And I mean, first of all, just the atmosphere those Canadian fans produced. If anyone attended that game and brought the noise, kudos to you, because I was blown away by that. That you guys did a terrific job producing an atmosphere. Just even seeing the players walking out for their pitch inspection and getting standing ovations, every single one of the 26 players who came out getting roundly applauded, coming out to the warm-up. Unfortunately, the Drake curse struck Canada that day, but to start it from the bottom, now we're here, that was kind of spine-tingling stuff. The national anthems, as I mentioned, very emotional. And then the game itself, just the way it played out. Sure, it wasn't the result everybody wanted, but a lot of people took notice about Canadian soccer that day. And just everybody who would come up to us Canadian media saying how impressed they were. And, you know, just that they played without fear and, you know, were super unfortunate to lose. And even though that kind of weared off after a while, that to me is probably going to be the one thing that would stick out to me from a men's national team perspective from that year, was just how, first of all, how busy it was for all of us after that game, because all of a sudden everybody wanted to talk to us. And second, just the entertaining aspect of the game and the fact that I think everything surrounding it was just so historic and so emotional as well.
I would say for myself, it's probably that Jamaica game when they finally clinched that spot at the World Cup. And I mentioned it earlier in the show, just how special those moments were leading into the World Cup, and just how exciting it was to have that possibility of Canada playing at a World Cup finals. And that was certainly something. So we'll move on to a question from Afrikaans. As it is almost a new year, what are some two each New Year's resolutions that you have for the men's and women's national teams as well for the CSA? That's a difficult one, because
it is.
I think when you think about it, the resolutions for the men's team have to be trying to lift a trophy, as well as bringing in as many dual nationals as possible. I know that there's a lot of excitement around dual nationals and that Herdman might know more dual nationals than the public, but I don't know how many are necessarily still out there that Canada could bring in. Of course, there's definitely a few that are attractive options, like Odunze at Leicester City, the former Whitecaps Academy goalkeeper. He could be some sort of option to look at, especially at the youth level, moving forward in net. But I think you just want to find and overturn any of those rocks that could potentially have gems in them. So that would be for the men's team. Then for the women's team, I would say make it out of your group in the Women's World Cup. And it is a challenging group. I know that the world rankings don't necessarily say that, but we've seen Canada play tough games against Nigeria. And so it's going to be a tougher group. So I think make it out of the group and then make it to the semifinal and go and win the World Cup as well. It is a bit of a more difficult type of equation for the women's team, I find, just because there's so much focus on the World Cup this year, but also qualify for the Olympics. I'm not sure whether that game's this year or next, early in 2024, but I think their playoff against Jamaica is 2023. So. Yeah, so do that. Qualify for the Olympics. That would be my New Year's resolution for the women's national team.
Well, for me, I'll get a little specific here. And maybe Alex can chip in on this one if he so chooses. But maybe Bev Priestman fully embracing a back three. I know there are times when she does kind of utilize it, but I feel like she needs to go all in at times. And I think if she does, that would make Canada pretty unstoppable at the World Cup. So that's one of them. If I had to pick a second one here, I would say, and this is maybe going back to the question about what the media can do and what the CSA can do to sort of help build on this World Cup opportunity and to build both programs, but just more transparency with fans and media. And what I mean by that is, I don't think we're given enough of a heads up or enough media opportunities to cover this team properly. Lots of media would love to do it. And if we got more press releases, more media opportunities, U.S. soccer fairly regularly does roundtables with the coaches, with certain players, you know, with the federation president, what have you. That alone, I think, would really, really help promote Canadian soccer, as well as our national teams and the programs at large. So that would be the second one for me. For sure, if I had to choose one. Like, I've been fortunate enough over the last year or so to carve out a few pretty solid sources and links to the CSA, but there are only so many things I myself can report just based on what people are willing to reveal, whether they want to go on the record, whether they even want it to be leaked to the media in the first place, things like that. So I think if there was just a bit more of a buy-in on that end from both sides, I think that could do wonders. So I hope to see that. I'm not holding my breath, but that would be a resolution for sure.
Yeah, and I'll add, like, you know, minimum, like, look, John Herdman. John Herdman loves to talk, so why not give him every month? He just holds court 15, 20 minutes. You know, you get some insight, what's going on. Even little, you know, little things help to follow up on that front. To answer, again, the great question from Afrikaans, the way I'm looking at this, you know, all the winning trophies and qualifying for stuff, I think that's, of course, achievable goals. But a great thing about a resolution, it's little things you can do, little things to help yourself. It's like, it's not, oh, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to win an Olympic, say, like, I'm going to win an Ironman by the end of the year. No, it's, I'm going to run an Ironman by the end of the year. So I'm going to do these little things every day so that you can make your thing happen. It's more of a, like, pushing yourself every day. So I'm going to go a little more smaller scale and niche on this front, like a true New Year's resolution. It's going to be something more akin to run every day versus just try to climb the mountain at the end of the year. Just because, again, a good process sometimes is more important than anything. So for to start maybe with the Canada men's national team, I'm going to start small, give the tickets to Ismail Kone and Stefan Eustachio in the midfield, or give the key and then let them take a third midfielder with them along for the ride. I think now that the 2022 cycle is over, you build towards 2026. And I think Eustachio at 29 and Ismail Kone at, boy, what's he going to be? He's going to be 23 and a half, 24. I think the next time 2026 rolls around, build around those two in midfield, because I think as we see, midfield wins games, midfield, you know, control games. And if Canada has two very good tier one pieces, I'd say, in those two. So if tier one players win games, well, then you better give the ticket or the keys to your tier one players in midfield. I think that's resolution number one for the Canada men's national team. And then I'd say secondly, continue to look at options, I'd say, at the center back position. Of course, you know, just continue to build that pool. Because I think it doesn't have to be, I'm not saying go out and get a Fakayo Tomori. Of course, that's impossible. I don't mean go out and get a caliber of that player. Of course, if a tier one center back falls in your lap, you laugh and you pick it up. But I'm saying continue to develop the pool. Right now, the pool is about four or five deep. But every other position, the deeper the positions, the better they've been for Canada. Like, you look at the fullback position, look how good it's been for Canada in recent years, because they have, you know, guys like Mathieu Chouinard who haven't gotten a sniff, but they've been good enough that they've elevated the play of those above. Really, like, okay, there's this kid at Montreal who's doing a good thing. You got Zachary Bourguiar again, who was excellent this past year, barely gets a sniff for Canada at the center back position. They should continue to build such depth, you know, so that all the guys there right now, if you know, heading into tomorrow, it's Steven Vitoria, Daniil Henry, Scott Kennedy, Kamal Miller, Derek Cornelius. Get some more names into that pool to push to really elevate that group, because I think that's also going to help. And we saw on the men's side last year when their midfield was stronger, the depth they had pushed and elevated. And we've seen that at the forward position, all the depth they have pushes and elevates those there. In terms of the women's team, I just say continue to improve your play out of the back, because I think that's going to be the difference for them this summer at the World Cup. Because if they're playing European teams, these European teams can press. Like, they press like no tomorrow. I think the US is realizing that they press a lot more now, and they torched Canada at the CONCACAF Championships with their high press. Brazil, when Canada played Brazil the first game, Brazil wasn't pressing as much. Canada played great. Second game, Brazil was pressing, and then Canada struggled when Brazil was pressing. I think teams are going to click on that. Okay, if you press Canada, you can make things happen. So just continue to build or find a way to improve their play out of the back. And then from there, it's just, I'd say, figure out similar on the women's path, but figure out your midfield. I think, you know, Julia Grosso and Jessie Fleming deserve the keys there. Figure out a mix that gets the most out of them. If it's them with Christine Sinclair in more of a number 10 role, if it's, you know, playing Quinn as the number six, heck, if it's going full youth and bringing Simi Awuju and letting her just, you know, run amok with those two, go for it as well. So those are very niche specific things, but I think a little tactical tweaks that can help both teams.
And from Russ Kinney at Big Rock 3, 2022 will be looked back on as a watershed year for the Canada Menti program, as either a springboard for future success or a golden opportunity squandered. Which do you think is more likely 10 years from now? I would say, a springboard for future success, given how young this group is and in terms of the key players and the potential for those veteran positions to be filled by younger players who are coming up and players who also missed the World Cup as well.
I would lean that way as well, but here are a few little caveats to make sure that we need to be aware of this going forward so that it doesn't end up becoming an opportunity squandered. Prior to this World Cup, I think COVID had something to do with this, but even with that, the numbers were going down. Registration numbers across the country were in decline. And if you look at the 2000s registration boom, look at the age of a lot of these players. They would have coincided with that boom, right? And that's why you're now seeing a lot of these successful players and dual nationals as well all across the world. Since then, it's gone down. You hope the World Cup brings that back up. We probably won't know the true ramifications for probably another 10 years. But that would be one thing to monitor. And then second, you just hope that marketing-wise, exposure-wise, revenue-wise, that they don't blow another opportunity like they did at the Gold Cup in 2000 or like they did with the 86 World Cup or, you know, the 2007 Gold Cup when they made the semifinals and had a pretty decent team together but just couldn't make it work. That would be the other side of it. On field, I think it's definitely going to be a golden opportunity here, and we're going to look back on it as a springboard. But maybe some of the other aspects, it might be seen as an opportunity squandered.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a springboard just because we also have to remember, a big part of building on stuff is having the infrastructure in place, because these things can happen flash in a pan. Like, you know, you can have moments where just everything comes together. You get your golden generation, if you want to, you know, use that term. And then everything clicks for you for a couple years and then you fade into obscurity. What really maintains success is, yeah, there you go. You could go countless examples of teams, you know, even looking at in CONCACAF, there's been teams that have risen to the top. They make a World Cup and then there's not the infrastructure. There's countless examples of that. So I think for Canada, what's nice is that you look at what they maybe failed to do in the past. There's a lot of hope in place. I think another example you didn't mention there, Peter, 2015 Women's World Cup. Like, soccer fever was high in this country of watch Very parties. True. Everyone was going. Like, it was phenomenal. Canada obviously didn't have the result they wanted, but for a few weeks there was all Canada, all Christine Sinclair, all, you know, Sophie Schmidt, all the heroes of that team, all of Kadisha Buchanan's breakout tournament. Like, oh, this is, you know, legitimate. You know, Canada, she made a World 11 that year. I think that was the year she made a World 11. Like, that's a big deal. What happens? Well, you don't have a women's domestic league. You don't have a men's domestic league. People want to go watch soccer in the country. It's three MLS teams. Now, though, what's nice is you look at 2022 and, okay, this World Cup, you got exposed to Canada. Say you're one of the 4.9 million or whatever it was, average viewers that watched Canada, Croatia. The nice thing is now you look, there's 8 CPL teams across the country. You know, on the women's side, there's that women's league coming in, which is going to be huge. Because I think, again, the fact that they didn't get a women's league in 2015 is kind of almost criminal if you look back on it. And if you think, oh, for 2026, they need a men's league. Where was that sort of stipulation in 2015? So it's nice to know that there's at least that infrastructure. So that, say, of those 5 million people, say if you catch 1% of them, like, what's 1% of 5 million? Like, that's still like 100,000. That's still like 500,000 people or whatever. I think my math is somewhat off on that, but that's still a lot of people you can capture. That's still, you know, a bunch of attendance you can boost across the board. That's more people investing in the sport, watching in the sport. And it helps when there's infrastructure so that if they're interested and they've caught the bug, they can look and be like, oh, in April, I can go to CPL games. Oh, in a few years, I can go watch these women's league games. Oh, I can go watch, you know, MLS, et cetera, et cetera. You have to build the infrastructure so that you can keep people around long term. And I think that's one thing that struggle. You mentioned 2000. There was no, you know, men's league after to capitalize on the Gold Cup, et cetera. You know, even in 86, when reading Joshua Cloke's book, The Voyagers, one thing that was fascinating is that they realized that in 86, Tony Waiters is like, let's build the league. Like, people are going to do it. But then they didn't go about it the right way and it faded off. So it kind of shows that it's important to build that infrastructure.
Yeah, and I think you say that. The opportunity is there. The facilities are, for the most part, there. I know that there's a lot of projects to build more facilities to play soccer at a high level across the country. But if kids want to get out and play the game now, there's teams to support. on the men's side. There's going to be teams to support on the women's side. And most importantly, there's facilities across this country to be able to play soccer. It's becoming an accessible game. Whereas when you look at sort of what's been the most accessible game in terms of just being able to go out and play over the 154 years of Canada or so, that's been ice hockey. There's been ample ice hockey rinks across this country. And of course, ice hockey comes with a tremendous expense to play at a competitive level. But even just going around and playing shinny hockey, that's what makes Argentina, that's what makes France, that's what makes all these countries so successful at soccer, is the casual game. That's where the passion lies. And that's why Canada is so good at hockey, is because that casual game thrives at that grassroots level. And if soccer can become more prevalent at the recreational level, the registered level, and the youth level competitively, and also bring in that passion of just being an accessible sport across the country, I think that's important to the growth of Canadian soccer when you look at moving towards the next 10 years. But a question from InfoKid: what do you consider the most underrated man and woman for Canada? And I would say on the men's national team, it's actually a guy who wasn't there for the World Cup, and that's why I'm saying that he's underrated, Scott Kennedy, on the defense. I think that he would have been integral to the World Cup, at least coming off the bench, maybe not necessarily playing on the back line. But Scott Kennedy, I'm going to say, is the most underrated man on the Canadian men's national team. And for the women, I'll say Simi Owusu. She just won Canadian Young Player of the Year, but she has added a lot when she's played in that Canadian midfield as well. So she's still very young, but I could see her being integral to the future of the Canadian women's national team.
Just to those who aren't aware, because you guys obviously couldn't see Alex and I's reaction, we both raised our eyebrows when Ben said Scott Kennedy, and then we nodded approvingly after he said it. So safe to say we kind of both agree with that 100%. Again, to differ, on the women's side, I'm going to go Kaylin Sheridan, because I feel like she, and Alex once again looks like I just took his answer as his, always commonplace on this show, but the reason I say her is because for all the defensive success that Canada had, I feel like despite her playing very, very well in a lot of games, she never really got, I think, enough credit for what she was able to pull off. And I feel like this World Cup could end up being sort of her coming out party in that regard. I feel like a lot of people, similar to kind of what we saw with Junior Hoylett at this World Cup on the men's side, constantly underrated. I feel like he got a lot more respect at the tournament. I think it could be the same thing for Kaylin Sheridan. And by the same token, I'm going to beat this drum again. It's Sam Adekubi on the men's side, because he should have played a lot more. Alex gave him the kiss of death by calling him a 270-minute player right before the tournament, and then he ends up playing less than 90. Still is. So he still is, no doubt. But John Herman was like, you know what,
he's Alex? A 270-minute man on my team.
Yes, he is. And maybe you probably would have gotten a point if we used Alex's team. But anyway, for me, it would be Sam Adekubi. I'm going to beat that drum until I think he ends up getting more and more recognition.
Well, full disclosure, those are the exact two picks I had. But good thing I've always, I always prepared backups, just because. Because the Sheridan one, I think, has to be. Because like the one thing with Sheridan is like Canada has some world-class players. Like you look at Kadisha Buchanan, like one of the best center backs in the world. You add Vanessa Gill, that pair, you know, Jesse Fleming, Julia Grossa starting to become that sort of player. That's just on the group now. Of course, you could throw Christine Sinclair, Janine Becky, almost, you know, there's some top talents, but those players get recognized. Kaylin Sheridan is genuinely one of the top three in the world at her position, especially based on how she played last year. And you wouldn't, you know, you'd almost forget about that. You'd forget how good she's been for Canada in their biggest games, US at the CONCACAF Women's Championships, which, you know, ended off a great tournament for her. You look at Brazil in the fall, the Arnold Clark Cup, you know, and all these games she played, she was always excellent, always top tier. And at the club level, her stats were great. Her eye test was great. She helped an expansion team win the, you know, or not win the Shield, but almost, you know, push for the Shield, make the playoffs, et cetera, et cetera. But then, yeah, we do the Canada Soccer Player of the Year awards, where you have to vote, you know, three players for the men's and women's team. Criteria is club and country. Kaylin Sheridan, for me, I had Kaylin Sheridan number one on my ballot just based on club and country. Because if you look, I mean, Kadisha Buchanan,
excellent year at the club level, excellent year for country. I just felt like Sheridan was, you know, more integral. And throughout the year, you look at some of the other, you know, options. I feel like Jesse Fleming, you know, kind of took a step back after an excellent 2022 or an excellent 2021-22 season. You look at someone like Janine Becky, excellent for country, but for club, she was fighting for minutes. Yet those are the three that make it ahead of Sheridan. Personally, I think that just shows how underrated that she can't even be rated amongst the best on her team when I think she is. But I think otherwise, still, you know, in terms of a underrated player, I think I'll stick with Ashley Lawrence just because I feel like you with her, you notice when she's not in the squad. I mean, with Kadisha Buchanan, it used to be like that, but I think the emergence of Vanessa Gilles has helped stomach that. Whereas as long as you have two of Zadorsky, Gilles, Buchanan, you're fine if you're Canada. But when Ashley Lawrence isn't there, you feel it. I think that's the one where that's really how underrated she is. And then on the men's, I mean, Peter said Salmon Akugbe, which I think is bang on. I think the other one I'm going to go for is Junior Hoylett. I just think he's aged again like a fine wine. And I think I'm looking at my best 11 ahead into 2023. I think he's probably in it right now, which just shows how underrated he's been and how just solid he's been for Canada. That, again, you look at Canada, you talk Davies, Buchanan, David, you know, Laren, Eustachio, all these players, and then you get to Hoylett, which when it feels like he's been such an integral part of this Canada team. And the fact that he was so good against Belgium in Canada's best game of the tournament and, you know, didn't really start from that point onwards. Maybe, again, it kind of shows that even then he's still underrated in those sort of facets.
And from Matt Paternostra, compared to the contract that the U.S. have with their federation, what could the CanMNT aim to get with the CSA in their negotiations? Of course, this was the issue back in June when the initial friendly with Panama that was eventually scheduled after the Iran debacle was canceled or abandoned from the Canadian men's national team players. The issue has not been resolved. The World Cup has come and gone. The money is coming into the CSA, but it's a question of how much do the players, and compared to the contract that the U.S. have with that federation, what could the Canadian men's national team aim to get with the CSA?
First of all, I understand why the players decided to use the U.S. as a template and hire the lawyers who handled that CBA involving U.S. soccer and its men's and women's national teams. Because anytime you have a negotiation, you're always going to start high and then kind of meet in the middle. But that being said, I think the players are quickly realizing that in terms of the share of the prize pool and that issue only, there's only so much they can be entitled to without screwing over the women. And then also the federation, which I don't think they care as much about, because quite frankly, they probably would rather be rewarded for their efforts, and rightfully so from a player perspective. But look, I have been reliably informed that a lot of progress was made on the deal, both in terms of the prize pool and the future payouts, whether that's the qualifying bonuses, the win bonuses, what have you. The negotiations were tabled for the World Cup and holidays, understandably so, but we can probably expect a resolution shortly after the new year. I honestly wouldn't be shocked if the players end up receiving about 30 to 35% each. That's 30 to 35% for the men and then 30, 35% for the women. And Federation gets the rest of it. Most federations, if you do look at the averages out there, pay about 20% or less to the players. The U.S. pays the men's and women's national teams 90% total, so 45 each, dollar for dollar, between the 2022 and 23 World Cups. That goes down to 80% during the 26 and 27 cycle, excuse me. Therefore, I think starting with that number was always going to be a high ask. Receiving 30 isn't too bad, all things considered, but the CSA getting 40 or around, I think that's about 4.3 million USD coming to the federation, and then the rest of the 10.8 or so million dollars would go to the men's and women's players.
And from Matt Kipe at Canuck Tar Heel and Brenton Akasa at Caps Offside, what advice would you give to League One Canada to raise the league's awareness within the country, and do you think it would be beneficial for them to market themselves as the CHL of soccer, of course the Canadian Hockey League, the junior under 20 league across Canada? And Brenton Acasa, some mention of League One BC and the expansion of the pro development pyramid. Now, I've looked at the CHL for a while, and that's almost what I wanted to see the CPL do initially, is go to these hyper local small towns in Canada and get these tight knit communities to support these teams. Whether you're talking about, of course, Halifax isn't a small community, but you see the support that they have for both HFX and the Halifax Mooseheads in the CHL, or you look at a team or a potential CPL expansion to say Kamloops and the support that they have to the Kamloops Blazers, Regina and the Regina Pats. There's dedicated sports fans in these areas. And so I could see the CPL going into those areas, but I don't necessarily know whether marketing League One Canada as say the CHL of soccer is the way to go, because unfortunately it's just not how soccer works. It's not the one of two development pathways in North America. You can make a career in soccer in North America without going through League One Canada, and that's been proven for years and years and years, whereas the CHL has such an established pathway to make the NHL and to succeed at the junior level, to make the World Junior Championships and so many things you can get through the Canadian Hockey League, that I don't know whether that marketing itself as the CHL of soccer is necessarily the way to go. But I do think going to some of these smaller communities, if it's not going to be the CPL, then League One should do it and go to these smaller communities, put together a professional sort of setup and really build a brand, not just about soccer development, but about the community and about building sort of that soccer club, the full meaning of club in these communities. And while I love what, say, TSS Rovers do out at Swan Garden, Burnaby is too big to have a real passion around a League One team. I'm talking like Shawinigan, go into small areas in Canada. I'm talking going into small town Alberta, small town Saskatchewan, and building these tight-knit communities to support these League One teams, because then you can sort of get that set up to push these players on, to have the sort of responsibility players feel in the CHL. And so I think that's how you sort of raise the profile of it, is you raise the profile building from the bottom, not necessarily building from the top, at least in my opinion.
It's true that there are multiple pathways to the pros these days, which is great. But it's also true that League One Ontario specifically has produced a lot of Canadian men's national team alumni, right? And so I think that can be their stronghold, at least for now, is that, hey, all of the stars you now see playing at the World Cup and representing our country, they all started here. And I think that that is kind of a good angle to use, at least to start off in terms of bringing in fans. Maybe after a while, you don't have to rely on that too much, but I think that's why you're seeing the early success of League One Canada as a whole. Like League One BC has started off pretty well in just their first season. You've got PLSQ producing player after player after player in the CPL as well as in MLS, and ditto for League One Ontario. So I do think that that's something that they can do. And listen, League One BC, I was not fortunate enough to get to a game in time. I know you guys both attended multiple matches, but from the looks of it, the men's and women's leagues were absolutely outstanding, considering how quickly it came together. And then the fact that it was the first season, it also kind of goes to show you how much untapped talent there is in these provinces, and that having leagues like this is so, so important. So kudos to everyone at League One BC, and kudos to everybody at League One Canada for continuing to grow the semi-professional game and giving our players more pathways.
Yeah, to answer Matt's question, I think it would be certainly one area, again, because I think for soccer, there's so much, it's such a fascinating pathway to the quote unquote top that, again, I don't think you can market again like the CHL, like the next stop. Like the one thing that the CHL has is that, you know, unless you have the rare like Austin Matthews scenario where he goes to Switzerland for a year, etc., or, you know, in terms of North American prospects, like you knew Crosby was going to play in the CHL, you knew McDavid was going to play in the CHL, etc. Like that's an advantage that the CHL has, is because, you know, like for League One, like, you know, Alfonso Davies went through MLS, etc. Like there's not this guarantee, but what's nice is I think if one thing they should lean into is that, again, part of the reason that there's this allure of the CHL is that, you know, the next big thing could come there. Like, why do you think Connor Bedard is selling out all these buildings in the WHL? It's because everyone knows he's going to be the next thing. He's doing it, he's selling out, you know, 15,000 seat stadiums. You know, in terms of League One, they have to I think that they should highlight their stars because it's quite impressive. Again, the League One alumni that there already is. I think you look at League One Ontario, like Tejon Buchanan, like this is someone within this year who could be wearing the colors of Juventus, the colors of AC Milan, Inter Milan. Like these are clubs that like everyone, you know, you hear AC Milan, you can go anywhere around the world. People are like, okay, AC Milan. You look at Alistair Johnson, he's going to play for Celtic. Like that's a club everyone knows. And just 3 years ago, he was out there for Vaughan Azzurri doing his thing. You look at, you know, PLSQ, Ismail Kone, former PLSQ player. He's going to play for Watford. He could be playing in the Premier League this year. If you're League One, I mean, you should be pushing this alumni. Be like, look, like these are players that not long ago, look where they are now. They were playing. And I think that's one thing the CHL does well. They like they promote the stars of tomorrow. And I think if League One Canada can really push that, hey, when you go out and even you look at League One BC, you mentioned Peter, this just from this summer watching players, we've seen some future CPL draft picks. We've seen some players that have already represented Canada at the women, some U17 Women's World Cup, you know, U20 Women's World Cups. You know, important tournaments already. I'm sure within the next few years, we'll see players who are in League One BC playing at some high levels. You got to promote those players that have gone through there to show that, hey, you could be seeing the stars of tomorrow. And I think people will buy in because, you know, as soccer's overall fandom continues to grow, there's always going to be an appetite in any sport to be the one who saw the next thing, who saw the next big thing, especially with, you know, how the product in League One, I think, is surprisingly good. Again, as someone who watches a lot of soccer, I enjoy watching League One games because it's a good mix of, you know, young players trying to grow. They make mistakes. It's open. But then they're also, you know, it's not horrendous soccer. There's not like a lack of shape. There's not a lack of tactical discipline. And I think if they can really lean into, hey, look, this is a good league, but this is also a league that really might be developing players that in 3 years can be like, oh, I watched him at Vaughan Azzurri, or I watched her playing for Varsity FC, and you know, or I was watching them play for Blainville. Like you can say that, and people will want that. There's a reason why the CHL is popular. Of course, it's a great product, but there's also that mix of great product, you know, the players of the future. And I think if they can lean into that, top class.
And also from Brenton Acasa at Caps Offside, would love to see some consideration of Berardo Whitecaps in Canada Soccer, as well as the Montagliani fiasco. It wasn't all sunshine and roses for Canadian soccer this year. Of course, Bob Berardo being finally sentenced to a prison sentence this year for his misactions with the Whitecaps women's team, as well as Canada Soccer and youth teams across BC as well. Certainly not all sunshine and roses for Canadian soccer this year, and good that Berardo is behind bars and getting his punishment. And when you look at across the NWSL as well, it hasn't been sort of a fantastic year, and that's something that needs to continue to be worked on. Not only punishing past mistakes, but safe sport and making sure that safe sport is a continuous process. It's not a one-time thing. It's not a one-time seminar. It's something that you're doing every day and keeping a focus on to make sure that these situations don't happen in the future. These people are not involved within the sport going forward, and that sport is safe for everybody who chooses to play. And I think that there's some great minds that are coming into safe sport in Canada. And I think that you look at unions such as Athletes Can that really sort of are able to defend Canadian athletes, as well as Global Athlete that Kira McCormack has been working with throughout her case. And so I do think that you just have to have a focus on safe sport as a continuous effort and a continuous job to do. It's not a one-time thing. But certainly a difficult year in that sense for Canadian soccer, especially on the women's side.
It was. And the fact that you had such contrasting reports on the Canada soccer side of things and the Whitecaps side of things, I think just explains that there wasn't enough accountability on really both ends. Like clearly the McLaren report was scathing towards Canada soccer, and rightfully so. They didn't do their due diligence. They really failed the victims as the report outlined. And that was absolutely terrible. The Whitecaps, it seemed like they acted expeditiously. That was, I think, the word they used in the report. But ultimately, they did their due diligence. I'm paraphrasing here, but that's essentially what they said. And I can't quite believe that one entity failed so bad and the other one, which was pretty much intricately as tied with the other, didn't fail as hard. It doesn't really match up to me. And the fact that also Victor Montagliani seems to be skating by on this is so puzzling. Because even if he did nothing, that's still terrible. Because he had to have known something was up. And he has zero accountability for it. He is ducking the issue. And I think, like with many other things in the past, when he was, you know, president of Canada Soccer and whatnot, he hasn't gotten as much shtick for these things. And it's honestly baffling as to how, frankly.
Yeah, I think it's a very puzzling one. I think the only like reason I can think is that he is being let off the hook from an external standpoint, just because the past CONCACAF presidents had their hands so dirty. Obviously, we had the Jack Warner situation, Chuck Blazer, et cetera, that of course they're going to look the other way for the guy from Canada, which I think, again, is that's not fair. That's pretty almost inexcusable that you know, he oversaw such a thing and has avoided questioning and, you know, an investigation of some sorts. At least, you know, if he was cleared of wrongdoing, at least, you know, some public mention of the process. I think that's just what's the most wild, is that he's been the president of CONCACAF and there's been nothing. So that's certainly something that feels a bit strange. And just overall, yeah, it shows that for Canadian soccer, it's important to continue to again build the right ecosystem, one that's built on, again, safe sport and other aspects. Because yeah, you can look at a situation like that, like, oh, it was 14 years ago, things have changed, as we've seen in terms of, you know, problems that still persist. The things still aren't perfect 14 years later, and I think the fact that it's been 14 years and we're still digging up details from the reports and figuring these things out just shows how much work still needs to be done to fix and build, and hopefully that can be done long term so that Canada soccer can have a, you know, a good, clean, healthy environment for the sport to grow in, and one for that kids can be confident in on the men's and women's side. And there is still some rot that does need to be at least examined and looked at, and you know, then in the right scenarios cleaned
and
up.
I do think, just last thing on this, there has to be a focus on the future and moving forward. And yes, what has happened in the past is extremely bad and not something that can be disregarded, but I think the most important focus has to be on how to keep sports safe in the future, because that's really all you can control going forward. The last thing we want is more situations of that sort. So there's definitely situations in the past, but if there's only so much effort that can be put in, then I think that has to go towards the future. But there's definitely an importance at looking at the past as well. But we'll get into a few other things that happened in Canadian soccer in 2022, and plenty of noteworthy items to close out this year. Derek Cornelius from the men's national team, he's over to Malmo in Sweden, leaving Panathinaikos and the Vancouver Whitecaps to Malmo, a former club of Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Daniil Henry moving over to Minnesota United. He was released from Toronto FC and found a deal with Minnesota, which is definitely positive to see him sticking around in MLS at a good level. Gabby Carl moving over to the NWSL from Sweden, and she's going to play with the Washington Spirit. Canada's U17s had a camp in Mexico, and there's been lots of CPL moves as well, including Isaiah Johnston leaving York United, and of course the CPL sports draft. And as we look ahead to a few of our other questions from Cam at the Cam Moore, what does Canada need to do to secure players with dual nationality? Missing out on Tomori is such a bummer. From Matthew Hjorchuk, with John Herdman tweeting about focusing on recruiting duels besides Luka Koliosho, which other European dual nationals should he prioritize? And from Nick Spirit, in his interview with Andy Petrillo, John Herdman said he received several calls after the Belgium game from dual nationals wanting to be a part of the team. Who do you think they were?
I think you can probably guess who some of those dual nationals were. Daniel Jevison would probably be top of mind. And you'll kind of recall when Herdman, I believe it was in September, when he was kind of talking about, and I think even prior to September as well, he's touched on it a few times, the agent influence in a lot of these decisions. And the fact that Canada is now at a World Cup, you're going to start to see the positive influence of that. And I think guys like Jevison, who probably do want to play for Canada primarily, they're going to start getting advice from their agents to, yeah, you know what, pursue that, go with that. And so I think those are the kind of guys that he's kind of probably speaking to. I would imagine the likes of Lukasz Dias as well. But in terms of which other European dual nationals he should prioritize, mentioned him on the show a couple of times, Amir Batyrev, who's playing for Sochi in Russia. That's a name that you could probably look out for. coming in the next few months, especially if he can keep playing, even if it's just off the bench every once in a while. And then what they can do to keep securing more players with dual nationality. I think there's a number of things you can do, but I think what they have done so far has worked because they've kept in contact. They've showed these players that they've been wanted, and Herdman's track record with dual nationals overall is very strong. I know he's missed out on one or two, but overall, guys, he's done very well to deepen the player pool through dual nationals. So I think from that perspective, he's doing well. But I also think that in terms of the younger guys, like your Bruno Davidsons, who are still uncapped and probably leaning Canada, but do also have those other options like Scotland and whatnot, you have to have youth camps. And this is a great way that you can convince dual nationals to play for Canada, because if you get them in that setting, if you get them representing the country, even if it's at youth level, that can do a lot to sway a player. Because Stefan Mitrovic came on this show a little over a year ago and did say, and I know we can take his words with a pinch of salt these days, but he did say that if Canada had youth camps, he probably would have played for Canada and therefore would have leaned more towards playing for Canada at the senior level. And who knows, if he was in the setup at that time, Canada probably would have been just as enticed to cap tie him as quickly as they would have.
Yeah, well, I think one nice thing on the dual national front is that Canada does talk the talk. I mean, again, they've done a good job of convincing, you know, a lot of good players, especially for the most part, those that they've missed out on. You can at least point to maybe outside influences making the decision a lot tougher. You know, you look at, you say again, the Stefan Mitrovic situation or the Marcelo Flores. You know, there's a lot going on outside as well that maybe Canada wasn't going to control. And I think the fact that they've talked the talk is good. Again, they just got to continue walking the walk, which means offering more of those opportunities, be it youth camps, be it, you know, just games in general. You can bring them up a la Luka Koleosho, because that sort of stuff, that sticks. I think for a guy like Luka Koleosho, the chance that he's had the chance to train multiple times with Jonathan David, Alphonso Davies, Tejan Buchanan, etc., when it comes to making a decision, that will pay off. And you can only imagine what it's going to do in a few years. Say, you know, we'll throw out another promising dual national, Jesse Costa. We saw how much he loved playing for Canada's U-20s this summer. You can only imagine that, say, in a few years' time, if it comes down to making a decision, that sort of stuff is going to stick. So I think for Canada, they certainly got to keep doing what they're doing in one sense. Like, again, even pre-World Cup, like, remember the September camp when Canada had to delay their squad? That was because a promising dual national was pretty much paperwork being filed, you know, every announcements being said, and then last minute some things fell through and they had to you know, cancel that announcement. That's just saying that even before the World Cup, some promising dual nationals were already, you know, getting close to be on board. And, you know, that so it doesn't surprise me when Herdman says post Belgium, even more were coming on board. We saw Ike Ugbo, he came on post Panama. He saw what happened. He's like, oh, let me get in on that. So there's certainly going to be a lot of interest. And Canada does talk a good game, which helps convince. Now they just need to offer more opportunities to sway them. And even if there's, you know, not just sway, but also offer them opportunities to play and cap tie, et cetera. And that's going to be the next step they need to do on that front.
And from Felipe Vallejo and Meg Lefebvre, obviously the FIFA rankings are trivial in terms of reflecting a nation's ability, but is Canada dropping out of the top 50, especially after reaching as high as 33rd in February this year, going to have a negative impact on Canada's 2023? And if you haven't seen it on Twitter or on the various different Canadian soccer forums, Canada Soccer is dropping down to 53rd in the world and out of the top 50 after their three losses at the World Cup. Of course, World Cup games weighted the most out of any games in the 4 years. Fortunately, it is about as far as you can get from these rankings truly mattering in terms of World Cup pods.
Well, yeah, and plus, if you end up using FIFA rankings to seed a Copa America, you have a couple years to be able to build up your ranking again. So it's not the end of the world, and it fluctuates all the time, especially as you play in more significant competitions and play in these marquee games. You're going to expect a large rise and fall like that. It's not until you routinely are in that top 30 for a significant period of time and build up enough points and successful results that you don't see as much change. So for a team like Canada, you're probably going to see this pretty crazy fluctuation over the next few months. But again, if you win a trophy, if you win two trophies, let's really aim for the stars. That's when you can really start to solidify your ranking over time, so that if you end up suffering a couple of really significant losses in marquee competitions in a row, it's not going to hurt you as much. So no, I don't think it's really going to hurt their 2023 whatsoever, to be honest, because teams are still going to be interested in playing them. It might help or hurt the odd player who wants to move to England, but otherwise, like, the majority of players who would be linked anyway would meet the minutes requirement regardless. So I don't think it's going to hurt in that way, but changing the world rankings, like, I don't really know what else can be done. Like, people rip on the world rankings, but how else could they really be accumulated? Like, you weigh certain tournaments and games over others. You have a certain point system, and that's how it works. Like, I've personally never had any issue with the FIFA ranking system. It's done the job for several years. I don't really see it changing anytime soon.
I think Canada, the nice thing is that in March, they can pretty much just get back into the top 50. Like, I'm looking, like, two wins in March over Curaçao, Honduras, Nations League, so they're weighted higher. My rough math is Canada already pushed in the top 45 at the very least. Like, it's not going to be hard for Canada to climb up. I think the top 50 thing is important just to stay in the top 50, because in terms of the minutes requirement, you do have to look over the last year. Like, guys like Ismail Kone and Richie Larea, I don't know if they're able to make those sorts of moves to England that they did had Canada not been in the top 50. So I do think it is important. Of course, Alistair
Larea would have. UK passport. Larea would have gone. Kone, not so much.
Even then, I'm not sure, because I'm pretty sure if when you're outside the top 50, like, you have to be like the top player for your national team. Like, it is pretty
90% of minutes, is it not? I think somewhere around there.
It's something like that. So Larea would have been close, because we have to remember he'd been splitting minutes with at fullback. So I'd just say, like, you want to get top 50 just because then the thresholds get so much lower. Like, again, you got a guy like Ismail Kone, who no chance he clears the minutes threshold had Canada not been in the top 50. Otherwise, in terms of the FIFA rankings, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see this year for Canada, because it's such a weird system with tournaments, because the group stage matches count the most. Canada hurt themselves by losing three group stage matches, because when you reach the knockout rounds of any tournament, you cannot lose points. It's house money. It's bonus money, so to speak. Part of the reason Canada climbed so much in 2021 was because, A, they lost like two games, period. But then they won against Costa Rica at the Gold Cup in the knockout stage. And that was huge, because that gave them these bonus points that they made up from losing to the US at the Gold Cup. So, for example, this summer at the Gold Cup, they need to win all their group stage games. And I think that's not that unrealistic, because now is they'll probably be a pot one team for once, so they won't have Mexico or the US. They should run the table in their group, and that's huge, because once you make the knockout rounds of any tournament, you don't lose. That's why Morocco's 11th now in the world, because they made it out of their group undefeated, so they didn't lose any points. You win two couple knockout games. By the time they got to France, Croatia, and they lost twice, they can't lose points, because in the World Cup or Nations League or Gold Cup or any tournament, you cannot lose points in the knockout stages. So I think as long as Canada avoids any Nations League disaster and any group stage Gold Cup disaster, they'll certainly, I'd say, push up to top 40, top 30 very quickly again. In terms of the rankings, I think one thing is that I feel like it's a bit too weighted for 4, 5, 6 years ago. Like, the fact that Belgium had headed into this World Cup as the number two team, and even now they're still fourth in the world. Like, come on. Like, after the World Cup that they had, and after the last year of Nations League where they maybe haven't been their best, the fact that they're still fourth in the world, I'd say it would be nice to have some sort of mix of the ELO system where it's a lot more rated now. And maybe if you want to impact history in it in some way, you have it in some form or another. Because, yeah, you look at the ELO ratings, for example, Belgium's 11th. I think that's a lot more fair summation of what's going on in the world. So that was the one complaint I have. I feel like it weighs too much in the 5 to 6 last years. And that sucks, because you go to World Cup draws, teams like Belgium, they'd still be a pot one team right now at a World Cup, which is, again, criminal based on what we've seen. So I think the fact that that sort of thing is happening needs to be tweaked so that it's a more fair summation of what's going on now. Because if draws are going to use FIFA ratings, then we'd like the teams involved to at least reflect more what's going on.
And a few quick fire questions as well from Ryan Brintz. Will there be a January camp at Camp Poutine? And from GRMN Pope, any ideas where the Honduras match will be held?
Doesn't look like there's going to be a January camp unless there's a very late change here, especially because the camp roster would be announced in the next week anyway. So it's probably not going to happen, at least based on the conversations I've had. In terms of where the Honduras game is going to be held, I don't think we'll know for probably another month. If I had to guess, I would imagine it's the East Coast. I would love to see it in Montreal personally. I think Montreal deserves some national team games, especially when you consider how much of the spine of the men's national team plays or has played for CF Montreal. I think it would only make sense to have it there, but that would be what I would lean towards in terms of where the game would be played. It's somewhere out east.
It's going to be interesting to see the landscape of weather in March. Because of that BC Place also, I'd say, has to be, if anything, yeah, maybe BC Place. Big O is putting in new turf, and maybe that turf is finally something that's not horrendous grades. So, yeah, Montreal, Vancouver, maybe, and one of the big domes.
And from Aiden Steinke, any idea where the 2023 Gold Cup matches will be played? The final is at SoFi Stadium in LA, which could very well host the 2026 World Cup final as well. But we've seen games close to Canada in the past. We've seen Gold Cup games at CenturyLink or Lumen Field now in Seattle. I don't imagine that we'll see games in Canada just because that's not really been part of the planning, but I imagine it'll be a lot of similar big venues that we've seen in the past at the Gold Cups in the US.
It'll probably be in April is when we'll see it, because that's when the draw is, and I think that's when they'll probably announce where the venues are.
From Mark Carveo, so does Adrian Leon's performance against Sheffield United finally convince Man U to make her a regular starter? We're going to need her to get regular playing time to be ready for the World Cup. Leon, if you missed it, scored a brace against Sheffield United in Conti Cup action as Manchester United went on to win 4-0 in that competition. And I would say that, yeah, I think that she deserves more playing time anyways, regardless of whether she's scoring those couple goals or not. When you look at her play with the national team, there's no reason she can't do that in the FAWSL or at the club level. But I do think that those two goals against Sheffield are probably enough for Manchester United to see that she can play those more significant minutes and find success. The question is, can she find that success against some of the more top teams?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Adrian Leon and Manchester United. Obviously, it was good to see her make that move. Given her play for West Ham, she's just been so solid. And it's been a weird one. Like she scored in October. You felt like, okay, maybe this could be the start of something. She was in good form for the national team. And then she just kind of been fighting for minutes. And so the fact that she gets a brace now, surely this just helps her get a run. Obviously, it's a deep team. We knew that when she made that move to Manchester United. They got a lot of talent in wide areas in particular, which is tough for Leon. She's not really an out-and-out number nine. She kind of thrives as a inside forward of sorts. So hopefully she can just get her spot. And then, you know, what's the thing we've seen at these top clubs? Once you can get in a spot, get firing, get in form, she can go from there. Because from the minutes I've seen, it's been Adriana Leon. She comes off the bench, she makes an impact, she gets the right areas, and when given the chance, she will finish. So it's huge, because I think if she's not getting minutes, it's going to hurt her World Cup stock, just because there's still a lot of depth up front. Obviously, we don't know if Deanne Rose and Nichelle Prince will be able to make it in time. Deanne Rose certainly does have a chance. Nichelle Prince might be a bit tight, but even then, you still got Janine Becky. He'll be looking to play up front. Maybe you end up seeing Hoidema on the wing because, you know, her and Vian, Evelyne Vian could want to see the field together in that way. If Adriana Leon isn't playing, she isn't going to be able to stake out a starting spot. That I think if she's playing in form for Manchester United, she starts for Canada at the World Cup. So yeah, 100% she does need to be getting starting minutes because it'll be crucial ahead of Australia.
And from Luke, at Luke_17, where would be the best realistic landing spot for Tayshaun Buchanan and Miller?
It's a tremendous question, but I'm going to try to maybe connect some dots here. So Miller does share an agent or agency with Tayshaun Buchanan, who's been heavily linked to Italy recently. And Gianluca Busio also shares that agency. He's at Venezia. And we know about the Bologna links between Montreal and themselves through Saputo. So maybe there's something there. Alternatively, since Bologna does have decent center back depth, I could probably see a Netherlands or Belgium move for Miller. His agency has experience there. They have some clients there. Obviously, Tayshaun Buchanan's currently there, and it's a solid next step for him. And I do think Buchanan ultimately ends up in Italy, maybe at Napoli. It seems like they're pretty far down the line in terms of their interest. And they're going to need to bolster their winger depth by the summer based on some of the sales they're going to make. And honestly, I'd love to see Buchanan in Italy. I think he'd do really, really well there, just given his tactical IQ more than anything else.
Yeah, in terms of Tejon Buchanan, obviously a lot of links to Italy. I think having looked at each of the teams, I think the one I've settled on is, because I think there's no bad options, because of course AC Milan potentially goes and links up with Rafael Leao, he goes to Napoli, he could go link up with Kvaratskhelia, you know, I'm probably absolutely murdering his name, apologies in that case, but you know, the Georgian lad over there on the left wing who's been tearing up Serie A and the Champions League, little John Herdman there, and then, you know, a lot of good choices, but the one I think for Tejon Buchanan has to be Inter Milan, just because I think long term, Tejon Buchanan could make a fun wing back just because he's so good going forward, but he's so defensively responsible. So why not give him the keys of the way a Denzel Dumfries has been on the right side for Inter Milan? Obviously, Dumfries linked away. He'd be a perfect Denzel Dumfries replacement just because obviously it'd be nice to go see him be an out and out winger and have fun at AC Milan and Napoli. But he's worked so hard on his defensive game. Let's see him just unleash and become, you know, because I think the fullback, the wingback position might be one of the most important in the sport right now. And I think having a player of Tejon Buchanan's quality grow as a wingback in a system like Inter's would be good for him long term and be good for Canada. In terms of Kamal Miller, I think a team I'd like to see, is somewhere in Belgium. In terms of straight up fit, I'd say a Club Brugge, just because they've been playing a back three. I'd love to see Kamal Miller there. Another wild card is maybe a team like a Genk. Obviously, they've been dominant this year. Or even Ghent. You know what? I'll do Ghent because David's old team, they play a back three. As Peter mentioned, Kamal Miller's agency has links to Belgium. I'm going to go Ghent. I'll stick with Ghent. I think that could be an interesting landing spot for him to go play in that back three and then go from there.
And with Cadiz showing an interest in Larin, would this be a good move for him to get some regular minutes? Of course, moving over to La Liga, that the question from Matthew Horichuk.
I don't mind it. Cadiz are struggling for goals, and among the goal-scoring leaders for them is ex-Arsenal forward Lucas Perez. And I think that kind of says all you need. But the downside is Cadiz are a relegation candidate. So he'd potentially be playing Segunda División football next season if things go south. But no doubt, he probably does have to get a move. It doesn't look like he's in favor at Bruges, but you know, he got a few minutes off the bench there just before the World Cup. Maybe possibly with a couple of decent World Cup performances, he could potentially turn it around there before the end of the season.
Yeah, I don't know. The Cadiz one, of course, it's tough right now in La Liga just because they're 19th out of 20. But they're 7 points clear of last place, so they're not in the candidate with Elche, who are struggling. But they somehow have less goals than Elche. The least goals in the league does Cadiz. So in terms of needing a goal scorer, Larin does tick those boxes. Just 1 point off survival. Sevilla tied with Cadiz in the relegation zone again. Wild season for Sevilla. You sure have to imagine Bunu returning from the World Cup in good form helps them. But all that to say, there's just 3 points between 15th and 19th. Even if you go all the way up to, you know, let's say 10th mid-table, just 8 points between Cadiz and Valencia. So I think it's going to be a fight. And of course, there's always going to be a risk in that regard. One thing that you look at the stats for Cadiz this year, you know, at least in all competitions, but specifically in La Liga, they've only held 41% of possession in La Liga and 44% of possession in all competitions. I note that just because a guy like Kyle Larin, as we know, he fades out of games. You want to get him touches. You want to get him involved. And in a relegation team where they might be playing a bit of hoofball, they might not have the ball as much. That might be something where he suffers a little, especially at Cadiz only averaging 1.1 XG this season in all competitions and just 0.81 in La Liga. They're struggling to create chances, let alone goals. And as we know with Larin, he's someone who gets chances, he gets touches, he's going to score. So that's the one worry I have on that. Of course, you can't help but, you know, be happy with a tier one league, especially if he's playing. But the fact that he could get relegated, he might not get touches. It's one of those where I'm mixed. Like, yeah, it'd be great to see him in a tier one top five league. But also, I don't know if this is 100% the fit. So I'm mixed on it for now.
And from Jesse at Jesse_JM, could Kyle Hebert start for St. Louis in MLS this season?
He very well could. He's a cheap option in a position that clubs don't tend to spend big in. So yeah, I can see Hibbert keeping his place in the squad, but he is a solid ball playing center back. He's comfortable under pressure in those situations, relatively two footed. So could play on the right as well. That might put him in favor to at least keep his place in the squad, if not potentially start some games.
And from Hulo at Back Zephyr, in episode 101, you discussed goalkeepers out of the future. What about Chituro Odunze? And I had a few looks of him when he was at the Whitecaps within the Whitecaps Academy before he moved over to Leicester City in the UK. And I was impressed with him at a young age. I haven't tracked him too closely with Leicester, but as far as I gather, he's been doing fairly well.
Yeah, the only issue is he seems to be committed to the US at this stage. He was even called up in November 2020 by the senior side. Now, no call-up since then, and he's kind of aged out now of the youth national teams, at least at under 20 level. So he still kind of remains up in the air, but it seems like the last time I checked, he was kind of leaning towards the US. Of course, they are not short in terms of goalkeeping prospects, so might be a little tough to crack it, but I'm sure John Herdman will try, if anything, to maybe lure him over, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it depends what happens with him just because he's been in the Leicester system. You know, you want to see him make that jump through to a first team goalkeeper, potentially on loan, maybe at his age. So the one nice thing that Chituro Odunze does have, that from a Canadian perspective, is that he obviously came up through a Canadian academy. He was around when Alphonso Davies was around at Whitecaps. So that's obviously an easy link. And there's a few other former Whitecaps guys that, you know, obviously he'll be close with from his time in Vancouver. I'm sure Herdman probably even spoke to him back in that time, because Herdman obviously, you know, in Vancouver, in and around the academy teams. I do wonder maybe even if Jay Herdman knows Chituro Odunze, maybe that's even another link of sorts to potentially look at. I think, again, of course, you'd want to keep tabs on him and keep a phone on him and try to swipe him away from the US. So 100%, that's someone to look at. The nice thing is there is a lot of options. I mean, again, we've talked about Owen Goodman. We've talked about Tom McGill, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a few other goalkeepers in England, but Chituro Odunze has certainly never lacked for potential. Big goalkeeper. He can really command an area. From what we've seen, it's just he needs to get those pro minutes. And maybe when he does, if John Herdman can time it right, maybe snatch him and convince him maybe just to come get a look, get a friendly, and then go from there. You know, because that would certainly, you can never have too many good goalkeepers in your goalkeeping pool.
And from Paul Newmark, with Isaiah Johnston's departure from York to Huntsville and MLS Next Pro and Mo Farsi to Crew 2 last year, do you think we're seeing an establishment of a solid route to MLS? Or is this just another example of the varied pathway to pro? And I would say that Isaiah Johnston moving to Huntsville probably just further establishes that MLS Next Pro is a step up on the CPL. And I think we saw that through the level of play in MLS Next Pro. Not to say that the CPL didn't have a great level of play this past season, but MLS Next Pro, I think, maybe over-delivered in their on my expectations in their first season. And it's already proving to be a pathway to MLS. We've seen on the Whitecaps, we've seen players like Simon Beaker get a chance with the first team after impressing with the second team. And of course, you also see it go the other way with a guy like Florian Youngworth going down and playing in MLS Next Pro on a conditioning stint. But with Canadians as well, we've seen it with Mo Farsi getting chances with the Columbus Crew in MLS while also playing mainly with Crew 2. So I think Isaiah Johnston's departure from York to Huntsville is very positive for Isaiah Johnston, the young Canadian coming through the CPL U Sports Draft and impressing in the CPL. So I do think it is positive and is just another example of a varied pathway to pro. But I do think it's a step up for him.
Yeah, it is. And it was the same case for Farsi and certainly for guys like maybe Ryan Telfer or Jason Russell Rowe. I know he wasn't a CPLer, but obviously got a chance to show his skills with Columbus, and that led to some first team appearances. So I do think that it is a solid enough pathway, as is every other pathway. And that's what makes this so varied, I think. And we've said this so many times on the show, but there isn't one linear pathway when it comes to Canadian soccer. And so that's why, and I think Nicholas Friend, he asked the question, do you think CPL to MLS Next Pro is a good pathway for the CPL, or will it hurt them long term? I think for now it's fine. Like, eventually the CPL is going to aim to essentially ship those players directly to the other top tier leagues, as opposed to just MLS's feeder clubs and MLS Next Pro. But this is a good starting point, right? Because if you can get players into those settings, if they can prove their worth and lock down first team places, that's going to lead to other clubs eventually further up the pyramid taking chances on those guys. And this is how it really all starts. You got to keep in mind, this is only the second full, proper, uninterrupted non-COVID season we've had of CPL, and we're already seeing this sort of success in terms of exporting players.
What I think is great is that it's a good pipeline between the two. Because I think one thing maybe that I will disagree with from your earlier point, Ben, is that I think there's the level between the two leagues is similar. I don't think you can say MLS Next Pro is better or worse. One thing I did notice with MLS Next Pro this year was that there's very, like, the Crew 2, that's a good team. Like, that's a team that they would play CPL teams and they would be a tough time. Like, and there's a reason why Jason Russell Rowe, Mo Farsi, et cetera, they're moving up. St. Louis, yeah, we saw they had Bundesliga players on their team. Like, St. Louis was a good team. But then we also saw those two teams ran over other teams. Like, there were some teams that weren't very, you know, they weren't very good. They struggled. You know, some teams in the West in particular, on the bottom half of the West. And the East, really, the East was beyond Columbus, was quite the fascinating conference. But one thing I do like is that it creates a pipeline, because I think, as we've seen, some players can make the jump. Lucas McNaught and Joel Waterman, they made the jump from CPL directly to MLS. You know, the same way that Mo Farsi made the jump to from MLS Next Pro to MLS. But what's nice is that some guys like Caden Chung didn't make it. You know, there's guys that just they might not be ready. What's nice with MLS Next Pro is that it offers that gradual easing, so that you can, you know, it allows teams to make that jump. And that's what I like about Isaiah Johnson, because myself personally, I have no doubt Isaiah Johnson could play in MLS. He has one of the highest ceilings in the CPL as a midfielder. He can make that jump to MLS no problem. But what's nice is that he won't be thrown into to sink or swim, and he can ease his way in. And I think that's what helped a guy like Mo Farsi. You know, that's what helps some of these other guys making the move. So I like the pipeline just because it offers that chance for players to ease in. And on the flip side, it offers more opportunities for MLS teams to say, okay, we want to sign this guy. We're excited about this kid, but we'll ease him in. We won't have to buy him and then throw him in like Caden Chung was. And then he ends up suffering as a result of it. So I like that it establishes this opportunity. And I think it's good because all the soccer ecosystems, be it MLS Next Pro, USL, who we can't forget still plays a role, you know, CPL, et cetera, they can all help in pushing more Canadian players. Of course, League One and NCAA, you add all that into the mix, they can continue to help push into the top level.
And from Shovel Third, at Shovel Third, Thiago Cumbria to HFX, or Canada to HFX. I didn't get to watch much of this kid, but what are your expectations for him in the CPL this coming season?
I think they're moderate based on what I've seen of him at Palmeiras and then with the under-20s at the CONCACAF U20 tournament during the summer, because he certainly started off life well with Palmeiras' youth teams, but then kind of fizzled out as he moved up to the under-20s, and that's to be expected. He was kind of 17, 18 making that jump. That's relatively difficult unless you're just a otherworldly talent like Endrick, who I kind of have to remind myself is 3 years younger than him, and he's already got a deal secured to go to Real Madrid for tens of millions of euros. But anyway, in terms of what we could expect from Coimbra or Canada, and I really hope he ends up using that name on the back of his jersey, I think a lot of people would buy that, is that he'll probably be a substitute, I feel. He's not going to be a full-on starter. He can play as a winger or as a number nine, so that's probably going to help his prospects a little bit. But I can imagine he'll get in and around 1,000 minutes, 1,200 minutes, and if he can get 3-4 goals from that, a couple of assists and decent underlying numbers for his first professional season at age 19, which is what I believe he'll be when the season starts, you'll take that every day of the week. So as much pedigree as he has, as much potential as he has, we do have to keep in mind it's going to be his first professional campaign as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be exciting to see, because ultimately you just want to get him minutes. I mean, of course, you'd like him to have broken through at Palmeiras. I don't think anyone's going to kid that, but that's Palmeiras. Like, that's a, you know, that's a top club. That's a tough environment to try and get into as a young 18-year-old, you know, player. So if he can get minutes at Halifax, great, and really just establish himself, because he looks like an intriguing number nine with the U20s. You know, it gets into good areas, finishes well from that regard. So I think, again, if Halifax needs some goal scorers, so if he can be a guy, maybe starts out on the bench and wins their spot, especially now that they've got a coach who's really good at developing, you know, young talent, and Patrick Kesar, of course, the former Von Azzurri head coach. I think it's going to be an interesting mix, because I saw that question asked a few times. It was like, okay, what do you think of him, of Coimbra playing in CPL versus Palmeiras? Of course you want him to play at Palmeiras, but at this stage, you get all the minutes you can get. And if he's able to go out and get 1,000, 1,500 minutes this year, again, he counts for U21 Canadian minutes, which is always a bonus. I think that's going to be huge, and because at this stage of the of your career, you need all minutes that you can get. So hopefully he can get those and maybe bag a few goals and show why he was a highly regarded prospect that Canada really wanted to bring in for the U20s.
And from Dan Clark at DanClark999, thoughts on the hashtag CanPL Usports Draft? Who do you think can make an impact in the league in 2023? And when I first heard the picks for the Usports Draft, I was shocked at a lot of them. I could see Anthony White going to top spot. It made sense given his connection with the Vancouver soccer community, given his fantastic play with TSS Rovers in the summer. And he's a very good center back at the U Sports level and the OUA level, but I was certainly surprised to see him go number one. I did think maybe that number two spot to Vancouver FC. One of the players that I do think is going to star in the league next year is Chris Campoli. If he does land a deal with York United, he is rumored to be returning to U Sports at a different school. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see whether that is a U Sports contract that he signs or a full-blown CPL contract full-time. But I think one of the players that would establish themselves in the CPL next year is Milo Djurdjic. And I think that that is definitely somebody who could really establish themselves as a starter in the CPL. The unfortunate thing I see for him is he's a fantastic center back who could plug and play in any CPL team, except maybe Forge, who have won, of course, three championships. So I and Forge hasn't necessarily used a ton of U Sports draft players in their time as well, outside of Garvin Matusala. So I would love to see Milo Djurdjic make an impact, but those are the names that really stand out to me. If you want that, just quickly, Anthony White, Chris Campoli, and Milo Djurdjic being sort of my main three takeaways.
Yeah, the good news is for fans out there, I suppose, we've talked a lot about the CanMNT center back hunt, the next Joel Waterman, so to speak. There are some fascinating names. Another one that I'll add to that list, Eric Lejeunesse. He's super young. Like, he was this was his first year with UBC. He's just 19, if I'm not mistaken. Pacific picked him up. He was one of the best standouts I saw in League One BC last year, playing for the Whitecaps U19s. He would often captain the side, heart of a back three as a young center back, did very well. Obviously goes to UBC, a top program. They made the final of nationals. That could end up being a very sneaky pick, especially maybe he doesn't break through this year, but he learns from Amir Didic. He learns from Thomas Meyer-Jaguer. Maybe they move on next year. He becomes the guy after another year at UBC. I think that's a guy long-term. You know, Eric Lejeunesse could sleep on. He's someone not to sleep on. I think another one as well, Guillaume Pianelli Balsanoli. He's from the UQTR juggernaut of a program, a center back. Phil DeSantos, very good at developing center backs. They had quite the core last year at Valor between Nassim Mekidesh and Andrew Jean-Baptiste and Rocco Romeo. So you'd be excited for him to go into that fold from that UQTR program. He's 24, so, you know, a bit older, but, you know, again, someone who could go in there and continue to grow and to develop from there. So in terms of center backs, those were two interesting names, of course, to add to Ben's great choices. Of course, as the U Sports guy, do not doubt anything that Ben is going to say on some of these players. And I'll concur as well for the likes of Djurdjic. He dominated a few games that I got to watch of him this year. And then a guy like Chris Campoli, magic in his boots, and overall a lot of interesting crop of players this year.
And from Aiden Steinke, a U Sports player himself on the hockey side of things for the Trinity Western Spartans, Joel Waterman's old school, if you want to draw those connections. Do you know when the CPL schedule will be released?
I mean, for the most part, my guess is probably early 2023 is what I'd say. Probably January, February. Sounds like it's going to be similar season in terms of eight teams, obviously, now, as we know, it's going to start in April, likely preseason in March. Nice thing, I guess, a bonus is that there's no CPL teams in the Champions League, which obviously sucks from one standpoint, but in terms of logistically, that's something less to worry about there. So I think for the CPL, I'm expecting January, maybe February, but I think based on how things have gone, January for a schedule.
And from Returo at that Returo guy, in the early hashtag CanPL expansion talk of old, my favorite rumor was Alex Bunbury bringing a side to Quebec, either Montreal or Quebec City. Was there ever any truth to that, or is Quebec even still in play at this moment?
Quebec is still in play. They were present for the final this year, and there's sort of preliminary talks, so at least there's something there. In terms of the Alex Bunbury thing, I think it was, but then the pandemic happened and expansion fees went up, and so it just became untenable for him and for pretty much 90% of the prospective ownership groups that kind of wanted to start a franchise somewhere. So I do remember reading about this, and I do remember hearing it was legitimate, but obviously things went another way.
And from Shovel Third at Shovel Third, Moise Bombito was just named to Generation Adidas class of the upcoming MLS Super Draft. He's seemingly jumped out of nowhere, a young center back who looks sturdy and poised in possession. How do you rate his chances of him becoming the next big Canadian NCAA success story?
This is somebody that Alex put on my radar a few weeks ago, and ever since then, I've been mesmerized. Bombito seems to be someone who is very good on the ball, first and foremost. He's quick, reads the game very well defensively, looks like a very solid prospect, and looks like a potential stud at center back at the MLS level. So I am very excited to see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to like with this. From when the MLS combine names came out, just seeing, of course, the Canadians. First of all, the specs, on Moise Bombito, 22, so young for a center back. Of course, you have to remember that's the age that, say, Joel Waterman made his pro debut. That 22, I'm pretty sure that's when Kamal Miller made his pro debut. All that to say, for a center back, 22 is a fantastic age. He's 6'3", so he's certainly got that. He's a force in the air. Like, his aerial numbers were ridiculous this year in the NCAA. He was just a force in both boxes. He also scored a couple of goals because of that. He's good at the ball at his feet as well, which for a 6'3 is good. He played on the left side of a back three, back three, back four. He was playing on the left side. So he's comfortable on that side of the there. And now that he's signed to Generation Adidas, that's huge, because that means whoever drafts him will not have to count him against the cap. And of course, he makes a little more money as part of this contract. So I'd be curious to go see where he drafts. I think personally, given the Whitecaps need a left-sided center back, you see he's Canadian, he's 6'3". I think they have the 11th pick. I think that's probably somewhere where he could fall based on projections. I think that's a no-brainer personally, but even then, hopefully he gets drafted anywhere and plays, be it in the US, in Canada. Of course, you want to see Canadians play in Canada, but of course, the NCAA, as we've seen Tejon Buchanan playing in New England, Alistair Johnson starting out in Nashville, Dane St. Clair in Minnesota, going to the US isn't bad. So hopefully a team needing a center back looks at someone like Moise Bobito, especially now that he's a Generation Adidas center back, because just looking at all the specs, looking at how, because this is his first season in NCAA, it's also worth noting. He was a JUCO, of course, junior college transfer, for those familiar with The Last Chance. He used serious, you know the term JUCO. He's a JUCO transfer. First year in NCAA, was one of the best in the entire country at his position. I think that kind of shows the potential. Former PLSQ alum, I'll also throw in, his Bombito of Montreal. So he looks like someone that in the next few years could be a real prospect for Canada's men's national team if he gets minutes, if he plays in MLS. So hopefully on Wednesday his name is called and that begins that journey for him.
And a couple of U Sports players also eligible for the MLS Super Draft. Thomas Gardner, who has made his mark in the CPL, as well as Logan Chung, the brother of TFC's Caden Chung, both eligible in the MLS Super Draft among Canadian university players. And our final question from Chris Talks Footy: thoughts on the Canadian men's national team under-17 performance in Mexico, a 2-1 win against Costa Rica and a 3-0 loss to the Mexican under-17s?
Yeah, the Mexico loss was probably expected. I know they've had their problems at youth level, but they still have a lot of talent in that age group, so I don't think it's too much of a surprise. And I believe they made quite a few changes from the first game. I don't think they stuck with the same 11 as far as I remember. But in that Costa Rica game, a lot to like. And they mirrored a lot of Canada's tactics, the senior team tactics from the looks of it, which is quite encouraging. They started with three at the back in possession. They moved to a 4-4-2 off the ball, which a lot of teams tend to do anyways. And they played some lovely stuff. Canada Soccer tweeted out one of the goals that they scored, and man, it was free flowing. It was beautiful. So hopefully they can translate that into the under 17 championship in February, because Canada's had some decent success at under 17 level the last few years. So let's hope that this keeps on rolling. One thing I will point out is that half the 11 was TFC players. And TFC tends to produce a lot of these players at this age group. But then eventually, once they get older and start to push for the first team, that's when they kind of start to fizzle out, because they just can't get those quality minutes at the next level.
That's going to be interesting. From what I saw, I didn't end up following, of course, much closely, because we didn't even get footage, which would have helped. Maybe one day we'll get access to the match.
Another example, the goal they scored could do to help us, by the way.
Boom, that's true. Keep an eye on those of the future. But the one footage, piece of footage they did share, their goal against Costa Rica, to be fair to those young guns, they played some good footy on that goal. I think it was like a 10-15 pass move that went from winning a ball in midfield, going back to front with some one-touch passing. So, hey, obviously we don't know what the rest of the 178 minutes looked like, but certainly for 1 or 2 minutes there, they showed a bit of brilliance, which, of course, hopefully they can show a lot more brilliance at the U17 so they can make a World Cup, which would be, of course, massive for Canada's youth teams, because you can call in some talented U17 players that maybe long-term want to represent the shirt. So going to be interesting to see how they do. Obviously, the U17 CONCACAF Championships on the men's side, right around the corner.
And that's all that we've got for episode 103 of the Northern Football Podcast, our season year wrap-up episode. That's all we've got for 2022, a historic year in Canadian soccer. Thanks so much, guys, for joining me on this final episode. Happy holidays to all of our listeners. I hope you all have a happy new year. Can't wait to be talking Canadian soccer with all of you in the new year. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to Northern Football Podcast. It's much appreciated. We might have some news in the new year as well. Stay tuned for that. And for Alex, for Peter, I've been Ben. Thanks so much for joining us on the Northern Football Podcast.